This is episode 97 of the Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. I am Solomonster with you on Martin Luther King Day, Monday, January 18, 2010. A holiday for most people, home from work, some are not. Sucks to be you, but I actually have a day off and wanted to do the podcast a day late so I could talk about TNA's Genesis pay-per-view, which of course took place last night, emanating from the Impact Zone, where else, in Orlando, Florida. The first pay-per-view of the Hogan-Bischoff regime in TNA. And I did see, not the entire pay-per-view show, I did see most of it. Feed I had online was a little bit laggy, so there were parts I missed, but I do have some thoughts on that. And I do want to get to some thoughts from Raw last week with Mike Tyson, just on some disturbingly awesome stuff that I actually enjoyed from that show. And then we'll get to your feedback. I got a lot of emails to answer from you guys. So why don't we just start with the Genesis talk here on this Monday morning. Looking back on TNA's first pay-per-view foray of the new regime, it was a mixed bag. There were things I liked. There were things I did not like. One of the things I liked, and I actually mentioned this earlier in the day yesterday on my Twitter page when I had first heard that this was in fact going to be the case, is that TNA has discarded their six-sided ring for a standard four-sided wrestling ring. This is a lot of people in an uproar, a lot of people very upset that the six-sided ring is no longer a staple of total nonstop action. Quite frankly, I think it's a good move. I was never a big fan of the six-sided ring. Then again, I was never the biggest TNA fan. It's grown on me over the years, obviously. TNA used to be far worse than even some of the TV shows they've had in recent months. They're getting better. I was never a big fan of the six-sided ring. It just, I guess when you grow up a wrestling fan and you're so used to something, any change is going to be a bit shocking. And I thought that over time I'd get used to it. I never really did. When I went to the live TNA show in New York City, last February, actually February of 08, they came to Webster Hall here in New York City, and I was astounded by how small the wrestling ring was. Now, I know they were using a different ring than the usual six-sided ring, because there's no way that the six-sided ring was this small. I'm sure it was a special ring they brought in for the event, but I saw the ring up close and personal. Not only did I see the ring, I got into the ring after the show was over, and was not impressed. The ropes are very stiff. Just to kind of pry them open and get into the ring was a chore. You know, not that I'm physically jacked like Scott Steiner, but usually opening ring ropes is not a difficult task, and that was one of the things I noticed about the ring. And let's face facts here. You know, Hogan is in TNA. I have no doubt in my mind that Hogan will eventually wrestle a match. He claims he does not have a wrestling contract, which may well be true, and that he probably won't get into the ring, but let's be honest here. Unless the Hogan relationship with TNA dissolves early because it's not working, Hogan will wrestle eventually. He may not wrestle until later in the year, but he will wrestle a Ric Flair or a Sting. I don't see Hogan stepping in the ring with Kurt Angle. I don't see Hogan stepping in the ring with AJ Styles. But a Hogan, Sting, Hogan Flair, Hogan Mick Foley match of some kind, Hogan Jarrett, down the road is possible. And when you have guys like Hogan who are old school and you know, they're bringing in a lot of guys, former WWE guys, that are not accustomed to or probably don't like that ring much, I think it was only a matter of time before the ring disappeared. So at the end of the day, it's a fucking ring. We don't have to have a cow over it. It's not a big deal. But I actually liked the fact that they ditched the six-sided ring, which probably means they're going to ditch the six sides of steel stuff. And from what I understand, there will no longer be a King of the Mountain match in TNA. Again, I was never a fan of that, so kudos to Hogan on ditching that as well. You may not like all the moves that Hogan's making, but the fact is he's delivering on the moves that he said he would make. He said he was coming in. He said he was going to shake things up. And, you know, you have to respect the vision he has, because TNA basically gave him the keys to the car. And we don't know where TNA is going to be 6 months or 12 months from now, but they gave him the keys to the car. He has the power to make these changes. He's making changes that he thinks long-term will help the company, and we'll see. Now, one of the other cool things I liked was the rampway that was used to connect the stage to the ring. Very reminiscent of the ramp that was used in the old WCW and ECW days. And I like that. It's a nice added kind of old school touch. I guess it kind of eliminates the possibility of having, you know, quick run-ins down the aisleway into the ring, but, you know, no big deal to me. I like that ramp. Again, it's a different feel. For years, I've said that WWE should change the look and the feel of the Raw set. And when I found out that they were doing just that 2 years ago, I was very excited. When I saw the finished product, I was unimpressed. Because all they did was spend millions upon millions of dollars on this beautiful-looking HD set that basically allows them to put a big, giant advertisement on there every week promoting that the next pay-per-view is 2 weeks away or 3 weeks away. When you watch Raw, it looks basically the same. You have a big screen, you have a rampway and a stage that looks the same. You know, let's have some shows that kind of remind us of the old WCW Monday Nitro days. Let's have a small, modest set with a screen and a long, straight aisleway to the ring. You know, let's change it up a little bit. Let's freshen it up. That's what TNA did last night. Now, I don't know if that's their setup for their events in the Impact Zone going forward. I would assume so, and not just pay-per-views. I guess we'll find out with the next set of Impact tapings, which I'll get to that in a second. A lot of people asking me if Impact is moving to Monday nights. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But just to address the pay-per-view here, Hogan and Bischoff come out at the beginning to address the crowd. And the crowd is not very happy about the six-sided ring going bye-bye. And they make Hulk Hogan aware of this. Now, I like the fact that Hogan wasn't really, I don't want to say he wasn't shaken, because I'm sure he was a bit taken aback by those chants, but he came off very heelish. Him and Bischoff came off very heelish, which, again, I don't think was the intended effect. But change is usually frowned upon. Those fans in the Impact Zone were not happy, and they made Hogan and Bischoff know that. And they stuck to their guns, and they said, look, basically, in so many words, they said, tough shit. This is the way it's going to be, and we've got other big changes coming, so get used to it. And, again, I respect them for that. They have a vision for what they think will work. Let's give it time and see if it works. The Brian Kendrick surprise filling in there in that match as the opponent for Amazing Red, I thought that it was a good match. You know, I was going to say a good way to start off the pay-per-view. I guess technically it didn't start off the pay-per-view. It was the first match. You know, I thought it was a good match. You know, there was some more stuff with Hogan and Bischoff talking with the NWO. And wasn't too fond of the bait and switch, putting Sean Waltman in Scott Hall's place. Not that I'm arguing that Scott Hall would have had a five-star wrestling match, but you promote the fact that the outsiders basically are going to be reunited in action on pay-per-view, and then when the pay-per-view starts, you stick somebody else in Scott Hall's place. You know, I'm sure the match was better because of it, but I'm not a big fan of those bait-and-switch type of things, which, by the way, we had two different bait-and-switches on this show. If you consider the Bobby Lashley situation, we'll get to that. We had Sean Morley and Christopher Daniels. Now, this was interesting. Their match was fine. It was an okay match. But the crowd crapped all over it towards the end anyway. And that was the wrong finish. Because let's be honest here. Morley is a great athlete. He's a fine wrestler. He's basically been a jobber on WWE television for the last, I don't even know, 5, 6, 7 years. And then ultimately got cut by the company, too. He didn't quit. He got fired. He got future endeavored, as they say. So here's this person who comes in, and it's unfair, I guess, to label him this way because he is a good hand. But still, he's basically looked at, by the TNA fans anyway, as a WWE reject. So this WWE reject comes in and beats the guy that was wrestling for your world championship the month before on pay-per-view. Not good. Not good. I would not have put Morley over Daniels. I know Morley's a new guy. They're trying to establish him. I'm not saying Morley is necessarily going to be pushed higher than Daniels long-term. But then again, you know, I know AJ Styles is a favorite of Hulk Hogan for now. From what I understand, Daniels, for whatever reason, is not a favorite of the new regime. I don't know why, and it kind of bothers me, because Daniels, you know, first of all, he is an older guy. He's not as old as Hogan, but he's in his late 30s. I mean, a lot, you know, Daniels is older than a lot of people think. But he's an awesome wrestler, and he's one of the original faces of TNA. He's one of those guys like AJ, like Joe, who should be pushed. And to see him losing clean to the money shot against Val Venus is disconcerting to me. It's one match. There was a story they told with Daniel's ribs being hurt, and so therefore the big splash kind of put him away. I get that, but not a fan of this finish at all, and the fans crapped all over it. Now, the fans may not have liked it, and I agree, but let me just say something about the TNA fans. And if you are one of these people listening to this podcast right now who is an Impact Zone inhabitant, I apologize in advance. I am not a fan of the fans in the Impact Zone. I think the fans in the Impact Zone like to go to the shows. They like to sit down for Impact or the pay-per-view, whatever show they're there for. They bring their signs. They love to scream and shout, and that's their prerogative. You want the fans to be part of the show. You want them to be loud. The problem I have, and maybe it's just the fans in the first few rows, they like to think they're a lot smarter than they are. It's very reminiscent of a Ring of Honor crowd. And I've been to a bunch of Ring of Honor shows. I haven't been for many months, but I've been to a whole bunch. I love the passion that they have. But those fans would get on my nerves so much because it takes you out of the show. You're watching a wrestling show for the wrestling. You want to enjoy it. And instead, I find myself watching these TNA shows distracted by these chants. You know, they think they're so smart. You know, they turn their backs on Morley at the end of the match. Again, that I get, but it was a constant throughout the entire show with the constant chants, and, you know, the crowd was not up for a lot of the matches. This is a big pay-per-view show for the company. They're trying to change things up here. They're trying to put forth the best product they can. And yeah, there's a lot of ex-WWE guys coming in, and I understand some of the TNA guys are being deep pushed, and that's one reason for people to be upset. But, you know, get over yourselves. I mean, these fans are just, it's amazing to me. I'm not saying that, you know, they should be like WWE crowds, completely sanitized and just little kids, you know, waving their hands, you can't see me, John Cena fans, but not a fan of the Impact Zone and the people who come to the Impact Zone. I know some people who were at the Impact Zone last night, including Noah Mark. And I'm willing to bet that Noah Mark was one of these people who is chanting. So I'm talking to you, Noah. I know you're listening to this right now. Get over yourself. Can't stand the Impact Zone. They got to get the fuck out of that building as quickly as possible. I mean, that's one of the biggest things to me that TNA needs to do. And I know Hulk Hogan knows this. They've got to get out of that little building. It makes them look Bush League when you have every single show in the same building. At least take your pay-per-views on the road. I know they stopped doing that because it was cost prohibitive, I guess. I mean, they weren't losing money, but I understand why they want to stay in one building. I think they have a lease on the Impact Zone. It's an annual lease, so they sign it for the year, and so whether they use the building or not, they're paying for it, so you may as well use it. But you don't have to use it for every goddamn show. I want to turn on Impact one day and see them in a building that fits 10,000. So even if they have 5,000, you tarp off the top, you bring all the people down into the first few sections, and at least it makes you look a little more professional, you know? And maybe when the crowd, if you have a good crowd who's really up for the show, it'll sound louder, it'll feel special. I don't get that feeling when I watch a TNA show because it's so, and I'm not saying I have a hatred for studio wrestling. I mean, I watch old studio wrestling shows on WWE 24/7. I'm not saying we need to go back to that, but I like that. But all the shows are in the same place, and when you have the same people who I hate going to these shows, it brings it down a couple of notches. So that's my rant on the Impact Zone. I'm sure I'll have some angry Impact Zone dwellers who think I'm talking about them. I bet I have people who write into me who go to the Impact Zone saying, Solomonster, you're absolutely right, I can't stand these people. Anyway, where was I? ODB and Tara. I missed that match. It kind of froze up on me. I know that I think Tara won in two straight falls. Matt Morgan and Hernandez win the tag team titles from the British Invasion. The Invasion not on the favorites list for Bischoff and Hogan. That's all I know about that. So I would not expect a big British Invasion push going forward. Bobby Lashley. The Bobby Lashley situation. This is the other bait and switch that we saw at the pay-per-view. And the reason is because Lashley has a fight I think he has a fight. I know his first opponent, that deal fell through. Then he had another opponent. That may have fallen through. Bobby Lashley at this point is supposed to be fighting on the Strikeforce MMA event on January 30th at Alera on Showtime. I don't know if he'll even have an opponent, but we'll see. But he is supposed to be fighting, and so him wrestling on this show is questionable at best. Because Lashley should not be wrestling. He should be training for his fight. And so Lashley gets knocked out by Abyss and knocked out of that match. And Hogan comes in and talks to Abyss and says, "You're trying to make me crazy," and this and that. And anyway, it turns out that the big acquisition for TNA that replaced Lashley in that match against Abyss was the former Mr. Kennedy. Excuse me, Mr. Kennedy, Ken Anderson. Who, to no one's surprise, was joining TNA. It was just a matter of when and not if. I know Hogan was a fan of his, coming off the Australian tour. I know Anderson worked a bunch of matches with Umaga, who, had he not passed on, I'm sure he'd be in WWE or TNA right now. He would not be sitting on the sidelines. Unfortunately, he's in a pine box, which is a shame. But Anderson impressed Hogan and other people on the tour, and so he gets a deal in TNA. Let's hope he doesn't hurt himself or others. I don't think he hurt anybody last night, but his match certainly did nothing for me. Again, the crowd just did not really get into it at all. They seemed to be into him at the beginning, but as the match went on, they just seemed to, they just could care less about Anderson. They could care less about this match. Pretty basic finish. Anderson using brass knucks, I think it was, to knock out Abyss and get the pin. Really nothing more to it than that. He still does the gimmick where he announces his name. And we'll see. I mean, he seemed to be positioned as a heel, or maybe going towards heel last night, which I like, because I always thought Kennedy was better as a heel than a babyface. And I know he likes working as a heel more than a babyface, so we'll see. I mean, I used to talk about on this podcast, and I'll have to go back and see if I can get, one of those clips. I'm trying to cut clips from all my old, well, not every single episode, but a lot of the old sound-offs to have on hand in case I want to play them during episode 100 in a couple weeks. I don't know how many of them I'm going to get. It would just take me way too long to sit here and listen to all those shows again. But I know that I used to talk about the fact that I thought Kennedy was a future world champion within a couple of years. I still do. You know, I still do. I know there's a lot of people now on that roster in TNA, and, you know, Anderson may just get stuck in mid-card hell. And maybe he deserves to be there if he, I mean, again, his showing last night did not really do much for me, but I still think he's got the personality, he's got the charisma. As a wrestler, he's fine. He's not horrible, but he's not great. I think he could definitely be a future world champion in TNA or WWE, although I don't see him going back there. I think he's for now anyway, he's burned a bridge with all the stuff that he said about John Cena and all the stuff he said about Triple H. I don't see Kennedy back there anytime soon, but I still think he can be a big-time player. I'm sticking to my guns on that. I really do. Injuries are what killed the guy in WWE, and had he not gotten hurt, if he, for example, would have been the bastard child of Vince McMahon in that storyline, that was a bona fide main event feud for him. Would it have led to a world title? Who knows? But there were bigger things planned for Kennedy, and unfortunately, he kind of fucked himself on that. And I'm hoping that for his sake, he can find his way, and he'll have some measure of success in TNA, but his match last night really didn't do much for me. Wolf and the Pope, I thought, had a good match. Probably the best match of the show up until that point, although I did like the Kendrick Red match. But, yeah, again, Wolf wins that match. We had Eric Bischoff basically taking Jeremy Borash off TV, telling him he's annoying, he's boring, whatever it was that he said. I have to say, I feel a little sorry for Jeremy Borash. I'm not sure if this is part of a storyline or if he has really been taken off TV. I hope TNA does not let him go. I think he's a big asset to the company. I'm not the biggest Jeremy Borash supporter, and quite frankly, those bug eyes really creep me out. But he does a lot for that company. I mean, he's on the road all the time. He goes to the live events. He's hiding backstage passes. He's updating his Twitter every day. He's the biggest TNA mark that there is. He does the spin cycle shows. I've been to a TNA show before. I know that he really does a good job of revving the crowd up before the event starts. He's a team player, and even if he's not an on-air announcer, as long as they keep him on to do all the other things that he does, I think that's fine, because I think in many ways, Borash is TNA, and it would be a shame for them to get rid of him, just like they've gotten rid of the six-sided ring, although that I didn't mind. So I don't know where this is going, but that was kind of sad, actually, to see that last night. Beer Money against Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman. Beer Money gets the win. Not much more to it than that. I know, you know, Scott Hall came out, attacked the fan. Again, I actually missed that part, because my connection was kind of laggy. Again, not much more to it than that. I don't know how much longer Hall and Waltman are going to be around TNA. I don't think they have any sort of contract at all, quite frankly. I think they're just kind of showing up on a per-appearance basis. But, yeah, there was really nothing more to it than that. I already talked about Abyss and Mr. Anderson. And then the main event, Kurt Angle and AJ Styles. Well, I don't know that I've ever seen a bad Kurt Angle-AJ Styles match. So they had another really, really good match, almost a half hour long, in fact. So even longer than their match on the 3-hour Impact a couple of weeks ago. AJ Styles retains the title, beats Kurt Angle, and so theoretically Angle can no longer get any TNA title matches in 2010, I guess as long as Styles is the champion. I'm sure you are as amazed as I am that TNA would institute such a stipulation that I'm sure nobody buys into whatsoever. We've already been conditioned by WWE and TNA to not give a shit about these pay-per-view matches, or any match, quite frankly, stipulations, because they don't mean anything. Just like Chris Jericho. How many matches has Chris Jericho lost where he supposedly would never be able to show up on Raw again, and what happens? He's on Raw next week. When Miz, lost, I forgot who he lost to, but he was supposed to be off Raw forever. And then the next week he shows up in a mask as the Calgary Kid and beats Eugene, gets a contract, and he's back on Raw. And then as far as TNA goes, don't even get me started on Vince Russo and all the match stipulations that he puts together. So I'm positive Kurt Angle will get another title shot, probably in the next few months, actually. He might even get one next week. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But the match itself was really good. Ric Flair gets involved. It looks like, I don't know if Styles went heel, or if it's just a tease to a bigger heel turn, but Flair got involved and helped AJ beat Kurt Angle. I don't know if it's going to lead to a Kurt Angle-Ric Flair match. I don't know when Ric Flair will wrestle. I'm positive he will. Some people think he's not wrestling because he's quote-unquote retired. Oh, believe me, Ric Flair will wrestle a match. If nothing else, I'm sure that they're already getting ready for a Ric Flair-Sting feud. I know the two of them would love to work together. So, anyway, that was the Genesis pay-per-view. A mixed bag. There was some good, there was some bad. It was nothing blew me away. Ken Kennedy, as the big surprise, was predictable and somewhat disappointing, I think. They went overboard in the hype of a major talent acquisition, and I don't know that a lot of people look at Kennedy as a major talent. He could have been, and he still might be, but by no means is Kennedy looked at, even I think in the same light as a Rob Van Dam, who still could come into TNA at some point, but has not signed anything, or if it was a Bill Goldberg or something. I was a little worried it was going to be Sid Vicious, and I would love to see Sid back in one of the two promotions as a bodyguard or a character, not as a wrestler, because he's so damn entertaining. But, man, if they would have trotted Sid out there as a major acquisition, that would have been horrendous. I know him and Scott Hall are really good friends, so it wouldn't surprise me to see him in TNA at some point. I think he's nursing a torn bicep. I know Sid was wrestling on some sort of international tour weeks ago, and he left the tour early, claiming that he suffered an arm injury, and a lot of people thought, well, the travel on that tour, a lot of wrestlers complained that it was hell, and so they just thought that Sid made it up and went home. But from what I understand, he really does have an arm injury, so I don't know that we're going to be seeing him anytime soon. But I'm sure we have not seen the last of the quote-unquote major acquisitions, new people, new faces in TNA, at the expense of some of the older faces, unfortunately. And going forward, I guess we'll see who is favored by the new regime and who is not. I think it'll become very clear very soon. And we'll see. Now, Impact, going live to Monday nights. I've gotten a lot of emails about this. Are they or are they not? I think it's inevitable that they are. It's just a matter of when and not if. I posted on my Twitter days ago there was a rumor that they may be going live as early as tonight. And obviously that's not going to happen. However, from what I understand, Spike TV has two dates on their schedule up next for live Impact specials on Mondays, I assume for 2 hours and not three. And that is March 1st and March 8th. I don't know if that means that if those two shows do well, that it'll be live every Monday from that point on or not. I think within a couple of months, within 6 months, they'll be live for good on Monday nights. Although, if they have these two specials March 1st and March 8th and they don't perform well, that may not bode too well for their chances, but I don't think they're expecting, a poor performance. So March 1st and March 8th, it looks like those are the next dates. March, it'll be a big month. Obviously, you have WrestleMania at the end of the month in the Hall of Fame. Stone Cold Steve Austin announced as guest hosting Raw on March 15th. There's a big UFC pay-per-view, actually, the same weekend, as WrestleMania. And I think Manny Pacquiao, although he is basically ducking Floyd Mayweather, has another opponent. And I think the boxing fight on March 13th, if it's taking place, is actually taking place in Dallas at their new stadium. So that'll be interesting. So March is shaping up to be a pretty big month in the boxing and the fighting and the wrestling world. So that's your update on Impact moving to Mondays. Now, speaking of Mondays, want to give some quick thoughts on Raw from last week. Guest host Iron Mike Tyson, looking a bit heftier than the last time we saw him on WWE television. I thought Mike was okay. I thought Mike really looked bad in the opening segment. He just looked nervous. He looked lost. He looked like he forgot his lines. Thankfully, Sheamus' music hit. He came out to save him. So Mike, live in front of the crowd in that first segment, not good. After that, it got better. My favorite segment from Raw last week, maybe of the year, was Mike Tyson looking at Hornswoggle and turning to, I guess it was Josh, and saying the word, fascinating. Getting down on one knee and then threatening Hornswoggle's life made me just giggle with glee, telling Hornswoggle that he would rip his intestines out and play jump rope with them, that he was going to stick his two fingers up Hornswoggle's nostrils, rip out his brain, and then, for some reason, he was going to put it in a newspaper and then smash it repeatedly against a window or a wall, one or the other. Now, to me, what was so awesome about this, it was so disturbing to me because it seemed like this is something Mike Tyson would say in his everyday life. I'm not even sure that they scripted that for him. He may have come up with that on his own. I kept thinking, man, why can't they script lines like this for their wrestlers? I know it's PG, but shit, that was some awesome stuff right there. Really, really just funny. And Hornswoggle backs off, and I thought to myself, wow, I really hope that he follows through on his threats, and I was disappointed that he did not. I was very disappointed to see him dancing around with the midget at the end of the show. The Tyson stuff in the main event, Stevie Wonder could see that that was coming, but it was still kind of cool, I guess. You know, he brought his son in the ring, and Tyson reunited with DX all these years after he was a DX member, if you remember, back in 1998, even though he turned on DX and aligned with Stone Cold. Other than that, it's a pretty standard episode of Raw. Randy Orton getting pissed off at Kofi Kingston was interesting. I don't think we've seen Orton lose his temper in a while, and this was the first time in quite some time that he has done that. Obviously, he's had attitude issues in the past. I don't know if he was reprimanded or anything, but if you missed it, in that triple threat match with Cena, Orton, and Kofi Kingston on Monday night, at the end, there was some sort of botch. There was some sort of miscommunication. I'm not quite sure what it was. I'm not sure if Ted DiBiase, who did a run-in, did something wrong. I'm not sure if Kofi was out of position and Orton got angry. But Orton was very upset, legit upset with Kofi at the end of that match. He kept calling him stupid, stupid, stupid. And you can even see after he delivered the RKO, when the camera was on Orton after the match and he got his hand raised, he was mouthing off some expletives. God fucking damn it, I think is what he said. Not something that would happen if, certainly not something that was planned. And, not the first time we've seen Orton lose his cool. I don't know, Orton, I like Orton. I like his attitude. Was it unprofessional? Maybe. We don't know all the details behind what happened. It didn't seem like anything major. I mean, if Orton did not flip out like that, nobody would have realized that anything went wrong. I'm not sure if Kofi was supposed to be punted, and that he kept getting up, and so Orton got pissed off and called an audible and gave him the RKO. I'm not sure if when Kofi landed on the RKO, if he landed on Orton's collarbone. I know Orton's very sensitive to that. He's had his collarbone broken twice, and it was actually in a tag match. It might have been the Denver debacle when they had the wrestlers dress up in their basketball jerseys, and it was Orton and Ken Kennedy who just made his return. And Kennedy dropped Orton right on his head. And Orton was just pissed off at Kennedy, and he was doing the same thing. He was banging the canvas, he was screaming, and when the match was over, he confronted Kennedy backstage and dressed him down in front of everybody. And that was one of the things that led to Kennedy's release. It wasn't the one thing, but Kennedy was gone after that, and you know, I don't think that I didn't think the same thing would happen to Kofi, but it was just interesting to see Orton react that way. Orton, of course, won that match, and he will be challenging Sheamus for the WWE Championship at the Royal Rumble, an interesting heel versus heel dynamic in that match. I'm happy because it's a fresh match, and it's not John Cena, so you will get no complaint out of me for an Orton-Sheamus match at the Royal Rumble. But other than that, pretty standard edition of Raw. I know that Don Johnson and John Heater, whatever the hell his name is, Napoleon Dynamite, they're going to be co-hosting Raw tonight. Originally, Bret Hart was supposed to be on the show. I'm hearing now that he might not be. So just watch Raw and find out. Bret may be on the show. I know Vince McMahon last week came out and said that you'll never see Bret on Raw again. But we all know how those stipulations go, like I said earlier. Some Bret Hart stuff. I don't know how much of this you may have already seen on SE Scoops. I give a lot of credit on this to Dave Meltzer. He is a good friend of Bret Hart's. He has gotten close with Bret over the years, which is interesting. You know, Meltzer he is my favorite and easily the most reliable wrestling journalist with direct connections in the industry, has been for over two decades, really. And Bret Hart used to hate Dave Meltzer, as many wrestlers did, and probably still do. In fact, he was probably one of his top three most hated people, aside from Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair, and that's, you know, the reasons why. I won't get into that right now, but when the whole Montreal thing happened back in 97, Meltzer's account, I mean, his day-by-day account of the events that led up to the screw job is some of the best wrestling journalism I've ever seen, and that is what opened Bret's eyes, and Bret realized, you know, I could trust this guy. He can be a friend. And so it's interesting because a lot of guys have relationships with different wrestling journalists, but they're not allowed to talk about it. They don't want people to know about it because Vince McMahon and WWE frowns on that sort of thing. They completely closed themselves off to contact with the wrestling media. But Bret talks to Meltzer, I think, on a weekly basis and gives him updates on things. And so I know it's legit. You know, when I read items that kind of come straight from the source, so to speak. And so it's interesting to hear Bret talk about, you know, what it was like, for example, backstage on the 4th. Did he meet with Shawn Michaels first before he went out on the show? Of course he did. And basically, you know, as far as that meeting is concerned, you know, Bret and Shawn got together in the dressing room. I think Bret actually said in a Facebook posting of his that they got together in the cafeteria before the show. And basically, they buried the hatchet before they even went on the air. Shawn Michaels, on the air, was unrelenting in his opinion that it was Bret's fault and he would apologize for nothing. But in reality, Shawn did apologize to Bret. He was very apologetic behind the scenes, near tears, in fact. And both guys got a lot of things off their chest, and they really kind of came to peace with one another. I don't think they'll ever be best friends like they used to be many, many years ago, but it's kind of nice to hear that after all these years, they finally were able to put this thing to bed. Now, the one person that Bret did not meet with backstage and has not talked to, I don't believe at all yet, and this is not surprising to me, is Triple H. Triple H does not like Bret Hart. Bret Hart does not like Triple H. Bret Hart has said some pretty vile things, in fact, about Triple H and Shawn Michaels over the years in his book, for example. And I think I've talked on this show, I answered a question a couple weeks ago about Triple H's direct connection to the Montreal Screwjob and how it essentially, you can make the case that it happened in large part because of him. You know, and him talking to Shawn and saying you cannot accept losing to this guy at Survivor Series. It's not right. He's going to another company. Can't let it happen. I think Triple H also harbors ill will from that period because there were two different occasions where in matches with Bret on Raw, he was supposed to win and Bret got that overturned. You know, again, it's all politics. I think Bret had his reasons for that. You know, his logic was, I'm not feuding with this guy, and I'm the world champion, so why the fuck am I losing to Triple H on Monday Night Raw? But I think Triple H has not forgotten that, but he also probably doesn't like the comments that Bret has made about him over the years, and that's understandable. What I have a problem with are the, are hearing, and I do hear this from sources that I would trust, that Triple H is the one person in the company who is against the Bret Hart angle. He is not in favor of it, and that bothers me because I could see Triple H having an influence on things. Again, I think because it's Vince McMahon's baby, it's his storyline that Vince himself is involved in. I think it's safe. I think it's protected from any influence Triple H might have over it. I just wish, you know, Triple H is against the angle. I understand why he might dislike Bret, but I don't like the fact that if it was up to Triple H, this angle that I think can make them a lot of money, and that a lot of fans have been waiting a long time for, would not be happening because he does not like Bret Hart. You know, it's a classic situation of allowing one's personal feelings and politics to get in the way of good business. And, again, I think I think Bret is shielded from that to a degree. You know, it's just politics as usual in WWE. I don't really know what else to say, but anyway, back to the Bret Hart stuff. Both sides basically have agreed to the basic details of the entire angle, which is going to run straight through until WrestleMania. Both sides have veto power, apparently, regarding the minor details of the storyline, which, of course, is ironic when you consider, again, going back to Montreal and the whole question of Bret having creative control over his character in the final 30 days. I don't think we will see a repeat of any of that, but it's just interesting that we kind of find ourselves in the situation again. I said before that Bret was supposed to be in Knoxville on Raw tonight. By the time many of you listen to this podcast, I'm sure Raw will already be over. He was supposed to be on the show. I don't know if that's still the case. If they wanted to hold him off until next week, it would make sense. You just had Vince 1 week ago say that Bret will never be on Raw again, which we know is a crock of shit. But maybe wait 1 week before having him come back instead of having him on the very next show so you don't look overly stupid. And let's face facts here. This angle is running until WrestleMania. Bret is not wrestling any matches, at least until Mania. You have a lot of time. You've got to kind of drag this thing on. You don't want to kind of blow your load in 1 week, so to speak. So I guess we'll find out. But the expected outcome of all this will be some sort of street fight between Bret Hart and Vince McMahon at WrestleMania. You know, again, everything in WWE changes so frequently that who knows? I mean, it could turn into some sort of tag match. You know, Bret could back out thinking he can't do anything physical and they'll come up with something else for him to do, but that is the current plan at this point. Quite frankly, and I haven't heard this from anybody, but I'm just throwing it out there that, you know, you've got Stone Cold Steve Austin appearing on Raw March 15th, which is 2 weeks from WrestleMania. I don't know if he's on to hype a DVD or what he's there for, but to me, getting Austin involved in WrestleMania and having him involved as a referee for the Bret-Vince street fight, if there is one, would make a lot of sense, considering Austin's connections to both Vince, obviously, and Bret Hart. Austin and Bret had some wars. I mean, Bret Hart's favorite WrestleMania match of all time was WrestleMania 13 against Steve Austin, which, in my opinion, is one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. And for Austin to be involved would make sense. My only fear there would be that Austin may overshadow Bret. You know, I think that Austin has made so many returns over the years that his pops are not what they used to be. I think Bret being back for the first time in 12 years means more. But still, if Austin comes out at WrestleMania, the glass shatters and he gets a bigger pop than Bret Hart, to me there's something wrong with that. You know, and if you have Bret and Vince, the focus should be on Bret Hart and Vince McMahon. Like, this is the biggest thing in the world. We've been waiting so many years for it. It don't get much bigger than this. And I could see where if Austin was a referee and in the same ring, where the attention might be on him and people waiting for him to do something to Vince McMahon. But, you know, that's not to say I'm against the idea. I think it would be a cool idea. That would just be my concern doing it. Because we know Austin's not going to wrestle, so the only thing he would do if he was at WrestleMania, and maybe he can't go, maybe he's busy, but would be for him to do what he did a couple of years ago in the Umaga-Bobby Lashley match, and that is be a referee. But I guess we'll see if that's what they have in the plans. Bret, again, is very limited in what he can do. He cannot take any flat back bumps because of the concussion issues. He got kicked in the head by Bill Goldberg really, really hard, and he wrestled several more weeks, suffered a lot of little concussions, and his doctor said, quit right now or you're going to be brain damaged. And as far as the stroke came about a year, year and a half after that. The stroke, I believe, came in 2002. He retired in 2000. The stroke could have been from anything. I mean, he fell off a bike and hit his head on the ground. It could have happened to anybody, but most healthy people in their 40s do not just have a major stroke. And so it is believed that the concussion issues in some way played a role in that. And so here's a guy who has suffered several bad concussions, who suffered a major stroke, and has made, for all intents and purposes, a miraculous recovery. You look at somebody like Dick Clark, who, of course, is a lot older than Bret Hart, but Dick Clark was the iconic face of Americana. He had his annual New Year's Eve special on ABC. He still does. And you watch Dick Clark on TV now, he has suffered a stroke several years ago, and it's sad, because I'm sure in some ways he has recovered, and he's able to live a relatively normal life, but you look at him and you listen to him speak, and that's one thing that he has not recovered from, is his speaking ability. It's very difficult to understand Dick Clark, and Dick Clark is a guy that up until a couple of years ago, my own mother would remark to me about how he had not looked like he had aged a single day, and the guy is almost 70 years old, and now I don't think you can really say that anymore. Bret Hart suffered a major stroke, was paralyzed on one side of his body, had to relearn how to walk, how to talk, all over again. He's a little older, a little grayer, but for all intents and purposes, he looks great. And I think a lot of people look at that and go, well, he can wrestle a match. He's, you know, it's been so many years, he's so much healthier than he used to be. And they don't realize it doesn't work that way. You know, you can't take the risk. You can't take a body slam. You can't take a shot to the skull with a trash can lid or a steel chair, even a protected one. It's too risky. It's just not worth the risk. So again, what you do with Bret and Vince in a street fight, I think it's a very quick thing. You know, Vince could certainly kick him in the nuts like he did last time, but I think it's basically Bret just beating the shit out of Vince McMahon in that last visual of him putting Vince in the sharpshooter. My only hope would be that if Bret can still do the sharpshooter. I don't know when the last time is that he put a sharpshooter on somebody, unless he plays with his kids, although his kids are older now. But, you know, is Bret going to be able to put the sharpshooter on somebody, especially somebody like Vince, who, while Vince has had matches before, he's not exactly a trained professional wrestler. And if you can get the move on right, can he hold it? Or is he going to lose his balance and fall over? I've tried to put sharpshooters on people before, and they fight me, and they don't turn over properly, and I end up falling on my face. That would be very embarrassing if that happened to Bret Hart at WrestleMania. I trust that it will not. In fact, I would love to see Bret Hart put a sharpshooter on somebody, because for all these years since Bret left WWE, we have seen countless sharpshooter attempts by people from The Rock to Chris Benoit, Steve Austin, Chris Jericho. I mean, tons of people using the sharpshooter. I don't think any of them have been any worse than The Rock. The Rock, as great as he is, and he's actually a really good friend of Bret Hart's, The Rock may have been the single worst sharpshooter I've ever seen. I mean, the guy would turn over his opponent. And first of all, The Rock stands up. His back is slightly hunched over, but The Rock would basically be standing up. And he would be screaming. And I would have to ask myself, who is the one who's in pain here? Is it the fans? Is it The Rock, because he has this pained expression on his face? It certainly can't be his opponent, because he's not sitting back on the maneuver. I don't see why this would hurt anybody. And Bret Hart would be asked about this in interviews over the years, and he would kind of laugh and say, yeah, I watch WWE TV sometimes, and I see The Rock using my move, and it pains me to see him attempting the sharpshooter. So just to see Bret Hart teach everybody else, including Dwayne Johnson, the proper form as far as the sharpshooter is concerned, to me, that would be worth it at WrestleMania. But anyway, yeah, Bret can't take flat back bumps. He was actually originally supposed to be slapped in the face by Vince McMahon on that show on January 4th. It was a hard slap that was written into the script, and he had it changed because it was too risky to take a smack to the face like that. Any kind of blow to the head, it's very dangerous. So he had it changed to what was supposed to be a kick to the groin, actually. And it turned out that it was more a kick to the balls, and Bret Brett actually thought that it made it look better that way. You know, Brett actually liked the fact that it was a good kick because it looked good, but it didn't hurt him at all. And so that's kind of how that went. And, you know, it's a little bit surreal to hear Brett talking about this. You know, for all the years he said he could never see himself coming back to do an angle, something where he would get a paycheck and work for Vince McMahon again. You know, the Hall of Fame was a one-time deal. He didn't get paid for it. He did it and he went home. And people say, well, he's a hypocrite. And you know what? He is a hypocrite. I don't know that Brett would see it that way. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I love the fact that Brett is back, but yeah, absolutely. Is it hypocritical? Sure. You know, but Brett's whole thing is that he contacted WWE. It wasn't WWE that reached out to him last year. I mean, granted, they've reached out to Brett numerous times over the years. They wanted to do an angle with him in 2006 for WrestleMania 22 and Backlash the next month. And he just didn't feel it was the right time for it. What a lot of people don't know is that last February, almost a year ago, Brett reached out to WWE and said, look, I'm ready. I'm ready to do this angle that you've wanted to do now for almost a decade. And WWE, Vince, for whatever reason, they were a little lukewarm to it. They didn't get back to him. A couple of months went by, and Brett said, look, if you want to do this, let's do it. And Vince finally sat down with his people, and they negotiated, and they came up with a basic idea. So all these people that say, including Hulk Hogan, by the way, and, you know, I'm a Hulkamaniac, but for crying out loud, Hogan's going on all these radio interviews claiming that the only reason that Bret Hart was on Raw January 4th was because of him. He says, victory for me, victory for me. You see what I had them do? That's a crock of shit, because Bret Hart and WWE have been negotiating now for almost a year, and they actually reached an agreement a while back, and they had this idea in mind for a WrestleMania angle. Now, could they have picked another date? Sure. And part of me thinks that, you know, TNA going live on January 4th may have been the final decision-making factor that said, you know what, let's bring Brett back on the 4th. But Hogan's insinuation that the only reason Brett is back is because Vince panicked and reached out to Brett, gave him a bunch of money, and said, we need you back, is a load of horseshit. Again, WWE is definitely paying attention to TNA, but they are by no means shaking in their boots at TNA getting a 1.2 or a 1.4, whatever it was. Actually, on the last podcast, I said it was a 1.5. That's actually not true. It was less. It was closer to a 1.4. 1.45, I guess, rounded up, which is still, again, very good, but those numbers, the original ratings were a little bit inflated. And actually, the Impact replay that aired that Thursday, which would have been last week, did a 0.9. which is only off slightly from their average, and that's pretty goddamn amazing, because for a replay to get that high of a rating is pretty impressive. So TNA should definitely be happy about that. So anyway, Bret Hart, no connection to TNA whatsoever. Even Bret has said that, again, I've been talking to Vince McMahon for months and months before any of this ever went down, before Hulk even had that press conference at Madison Square Garden to announce his partnership with TNA and Dixie Carter. So, you know, it's just more posturing by Hulk Hogan, nothing that we should be overly surprised about. There is a Hart Family DVD coming out in a couple of months. This is part of the deal that Brett signed when he came back. He was actually in Stamford, Connecticut last week working on the project. WWE reached out to a whole bunch of different Hart Family members, sisters, you know, I think Diana, who was Davey Boy's wife. It's going to cover, I know, a lot of the Stampede wrestling days and also just the Hart family in general, probably the Hart Foundation from WWF. So, you know, it should be an interesting DVD if you are a fan of wrestling history, if you are a fan of the old Calgary Stampede days. I know a lot of you guys are into that, you know, very big fans of the World Clash Championship Wrestling DVD that came out in the AWA. Sounds like this will be another release that you'll want to pick up. It's also worth noting that when Brett was backstage on the 4th, the three current young stars that he talked to the most were actually MVP, Ted DiBiase, and Randy Orton. Brett's a big Randy Orton fan. And I know Orton and DiBiase, he saw them when they were kids, and he hasn't seen them in a long time. So he was talking to them the most. I think those are the guys that he really is most high on, aside from his nephews, of course, who are on the SmackDown brand. Quick update on the death of Tony Hamm, better known as Ludwig Borga, from his WWF run back in 1993 into the early part of 94. Of course, I think he broke his ankle in a house show match with Rick Steiner in early 94. and that pretty much ended his WWF run. Not much more to add to it. I didn't talk about it because I didn't do a podcast last weekend. He did die. I think he was 46 or 47 years old. Cause is believed to be suicide. I think he shot himself. He has had a lot of problems in recent years. He was addicted to drugs at one point. He was really addicted to alcohol. He had actually cirrhosis of the liver and pancreatitis. And he actually was committed, I think, to an institution a couple of years ago for delirium because he was so intoxicated by alcohol. But the guy was a jack of all trades. I mean, he was a wrestler. He was a boxer. I wouldn't call him an MMA fighter because back then it wasn't real MMA, but he did do a fight against Randy Couture in what was Couture's debut fight. And he, I believe, Borga got tapped out within, I think, 60 seconds or 90 seconds. So he did all that. He was a politician. He served in the Finnish parliament in Finland. He did a lot of things in his life, but he was a little crazy. He was a little crazy. And, it's a sad story whenever something like this happens. My memory of Ludwig Borga, he didn't do much in WWF, although they were grooming him to be the main event heel. And he had that feud with Lex Luger, and he was on that team at the Survivor Series, the Foreign Fanatics, actually, now that I think about it, if you think back to the 1993 Survivor Series, you had Lex Luger, The Undertaker, who was replacing an injured Tatanka, and the Steiner Brothers against the Foreign Fanatics, who consisted of Yokozuna, Ludwig Borga, Crush, and Jacques Rougeau of the Quebecers. His partner, Pierre, was defeated by Lex Luger in, I guess, what was a qualifying-type match on Raw. So that's why you had only one Quebecer in that match. But now that I think about it, it's sad that three of the four members of that Foreign Fanatics team are dead. You know, Yokozuna died in 2000. Crush died a couple of years ago, and now Borg is dead, so Jacques is the only one left. It's kind of sad, you have to admit. 1993 was not all that long ago. What I'll remember Ludwig Borga for the most was ending Tatanka's undefeated streak. Tatanka was in the World Wrestling Federation for about 2 years, almost 2 years up to that point, and had been undefeated. Now, I can't vouch for all the house show matches and stuff, but I know on TV he had never been beaten. And so you figure you don't want to squander that sort of thing, and yet they had Ludwig Borga come in, and of course he had to cheat a little bit. He used a steel chair, but he beat Tatanka on Raw. He ended the 2-year-long undefeated streak of Tatanka, and I think that's his big claim to fame. He never won a title. He never went on to anything much bigger than that, although I think they did have bigger plans for him, but he got hurt. So that's really my main memory of Ludwig Borga. He looked like a badass. He didn't look like a great wrestler at all. And I will also remember him for having a cameo in Die Hard 3. Any of you Bruce Willis Die Hard fans out there, go back and watch Die Hard 3. It was set in New York City. He's part of the evil foreign faction, the terrorist faction, and he has a role in the movie at one point where Samuel L. Jackson sees him, and there's one or two other guys that are with Ludwig. They're posing as New York City police officers, and so Samuel L. comes over with a briefcase that has a bomb inside, and I don't believe it's active, and he gives it to them and says, here, you guys take this, you know, I don't want a kid to find it. And Ludwig, he had one very, very brief speaking role in the movie, and this was it. And they put subtitles up on the screen, and he didn't want to sit in the back of the cop car with the bomb. That was his big role in the movie. So, yeah, you could add movie star to all the other things that he did. But anyway, sad to hear of his passing. But that's the update. It sounds like a suicide. And so there you go. All right. Let's get into feedback here. I've already gone longer than I had wanted to, so I'm going to try to blast through as many of these as I can. Now, I've already responded to many of these people directly, but I'm taking the best of the best, and let's do them. Let's get into the mailbag here. Chris writes in, Solo Monster, picked you up at Sound Off 79 and have been hooked ever since. Love SE Scoops. What happened to Tony Schiavone? I used to enjoy him, but have not heard anything about him recently with the poor state of announcers these days. Do you think he could be a welcome addition to either TNA or WWE? Tony is removed from the wrestling industry. He is doing baseball games in Atlanta. I don't know if it's Braves games or the Braves minor league games. Tony has had a lifelong passion for baseball, even before he got into the wrestling business. And by the way, Tony did not get into the wrestling business because he loved wrestling. He got into it because it was an opportunity that came along. And if at any point he had been offered something in baseball, he would have taken it. He only got into baseball as an announcer when the wrestling thing died in 2001. Tony has no interest in going back into pro wrestling, and even if he did, I don't think that WWE would take him. Maybe TNA could do something with him, but he is done with wrestling, and he is happier for it. Dear Solid Monster, if you were on the booking team in WWE, would you feel comfortable booking a top heel like CM Punk to cut promo after promo stating that alcohol, cigarettes, and drugs are bad? Surely there is a serious risk that impressionable viewers, particularly kids and young teenagers watching without their parents, would equate these items with their hatred of Punk and feel that they would want to get back at him by consuming them. I have a colleague whose young son is a regular viewer of SmackDown who experienced this. His kid asked him if he should drink alcohol because this evil guy had told him not to. Would I have a problem with it? No. Because, again, it's a storyline. It's a character that Punk portrays. And not only is it a character, but that's who Punk is. That straight-edge character is CM Punk in real life. And like they say, the best wrestlers are the ones who play themselves on TV with the volume turned up. So I think watching SmackDown or Raw or whatever it is with a parent is the way to go in that situation. If you have a young viewer who is impressionable, if you are at all concerned that something like this might happen, it's up to the parent. The parent can either tell the kid you're not allowed to watch this show. If he thinks Punk is going to be a bad influence, then let him watch ECW. Let him watch Raw. Actually, don't let him watch Raw. I sometimes don't want to watch Raw. But would I not script it for those reasons? No. But you're asking the wrong person, because I don't write TV. If I was writing TV, and thank God I'm not, I wouldn't write it for the kiddies anyway. I would write it with a bit of an edge. I'd probably be writing TV that was far worse than that. So you're asking the wrong person. Richie from England wrote in. He was listening to the Sound Off and heard me mention the Hitman documentary Wrestling with Shadows. He was able to pick up a copy from eBay, which was a special anniversary edition. It had a few extras, including an interview with Bret Hart and the guy who shot the film. I believe that's Paul Jay. And Richie attached some audio from the extras from the DVD, which I listened to, and I just wanted to, it was not a question, I just wanted to mention this and say thank you. It was really cool. So I did get the audio, and I thank you for that. Craig in Manchester writes in, do I think Bret Hart ever really considered going to TNA? I do. I think Bret did think about it. Bret has talked about the fact that he likes the TNA product and a lot of the young guys there. Bret, up until recently, was a figurehead in Ring of Honor. He was kind of an ambassador for ROH before he rejoined WWE, and now, of course, Jim Cornette is with Ring of Honor. So I think Bret did think about it, but at the end of the day, he decided to come back to WWE. He probably felt that this was the opportunity for him to make the most money. If he was going to make money, he may as well make the most, and he has family working for WWE. He has a legacy with WWE as far as, you know, all the video footage of him and stuff like that, and maybe he felt that going to TNA would somehow jeopardize that. After all, you've got guys like Mick Foley, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Jeff Hardy that have gone to TNA and are pretty much on Vince McMahon's shit list right now, and maybe Bret Hart just didn't want to be on Vince McMahon's shit list. So, but did he consider it? Absolutely. Sebastian writes in, I will be attending the Royal Rumble in Atlanta, and I wanted to know if SE Scoops needed someone to do a live report. Well, we always welcome live reports, so if anybody attends not just the Royal Rumble on the 31st, but if you attend Raw, SmackDown, ECW, TNA, or anything else, and would like to submit a live report to SEScoops.com, you may do so. You are, in fact, encouraged to do so. You can send them into webmaster@SEScoops.com. Of course, you can send them to me as well at thesolomonster@gmail.com, but your best bet is just to send it directly to webmaster@SEScoops.com, because if you send it to me, there's no guarantee that I will get it in time. Dear Solomonster, have you ever thought about doing a live show? I think I heard you mention once before that you did one before I started listening. But yeah, if you plan on doing another one, please let me know. Well, for some of the newer listeners, myself and Noah Mark, who is in fact a Mark for the record, have done, I think we've done about 40 somewhere in the range of 40 live shows, going back to when we used to do SE Scoops Live. It was a show that we started doing in 2008. It was every week after Raw on Monday nights, and Raw was far worse back then, believe it or not. And it got to the point where I just couldn't do them anymore because A, Raw was so bad, and B, I just, schedule-wise, you know, waking up for work the next morning, I just couldn't do it. So that's why we don't do it anymore. We do it every now and then. We did a live show, actually, a couple of months ago. We did a few last year. And, you know, Sound Off 100 is coming up in a couple of weeks, and all I'll say about that is stay tuned. There may be another live show coming up very soon in the near future. Dear Solid Monster, Chris Jericho has undoubtedly been the MVP of WWE since his return a couple of years ago. He's once again done pretty much everything there is to do, and his feuds and promos are almost always the high point of these shows. What do you think Jericho will accomplish this year, and when do you see him getting another run with the championship? I don't know that he is going to get another run with the world title, unfortunately. He plays his role well right now, but, you know, these days he's playing comedy foil to DX, which is getting old. I mean, every time I see Jericho being pinned by Triple H in a tag match or a singles match, I cringe. You know, his contract is coming up soon, as in a couple of months. And if I were him, I'd play hardball and walk away if he doesn't get what he wants. I mean, those 2 years away from WWE, he was, you know, doing some acting. He was on tour with his band Fozzy, who just had another album that is either out now or going to be coming out in the next few weeks. And actually, one of the tracks from Fozzy's new album, Chasing the Grail, is the official Royal Rumble theme song. Those 2 years away for him did wonders for his character. I would hate to see Jericho leave, but maybe it's the right thing to do, you know? When Jericho came back, it wasn't a great return. He had a feud right off the bat with Randy Orton that segued into a feud with JBL that sucked. But when the JBL feud ended, that's when Jericho really began finding his stride. And when he went heel, he took off. You know, his feud with Shawn Michaels for the world title, they had a ladder match at No Mercy a couple of years ago, awesome stuff. His feud with Rey Mysterio, awesome stuff. Jericho found himself in the middle of a pretty big feud against the Legends for WrestleMania with Mickey Rourke. Turned out to be a bit of a disappointment, but we also got a Jericho-Ricky Steamboat match out of it at Backlash, which was really good. Jericho just went from one great thing to the next. He had the tag team with Edge, which ended prematurely because Edge got hurt. They plugged Big Show in there. I was not very enthusiastic about that at all. Let's be honest, it's Big Show. But it turned out to be an awesome pairing. Jericho and Big Show, I was actually sad to see them break up a couple of weeks ago. And I would love to see for the record, if Edge is able to come back, but is still not 100% for WrestleMania, instead of going right into a singles match with Jericho and Edge, which you could save for another pay-per-view like Backlash, I would love to see Jericho and Big Show reunited. Maybe if they can even get the tag belts back, facing Edge and Christian at WrestleMania. I know tag matches don't have that same, allure as a big singles match, but you're going to have enough big matches on WrestleMania this year, and Big Show has nothing else to do if not this tag match. Why not put together a Jericho Big Show against Edge and Christian tag match? Just saying. I think that would be pretty cool. And plus, it would get Christian out of that ECW crap. He's better than that. He should be doing something bigger. CJ wrote in with this question a couple of weeks ago, and I answered him directly, but I've gotten a lot of questions about the invasion over the last couple of months, so I just want to address it in one fell swoop. He writes in, I must say that I love the podcast. Let's see here. I heard you talk about the WWF against WCW invasion angle a couple of weeks ago and how it flopped. I mean this in no disrespect, but how would you book with them? Wait a minute, hold on a second. How would you book this had you had to have faced the same obstacles they did? Okay, in terms of contracts and not being able to get the bigger guys. Well, anyway, here's the deal with the invasion. And this is exactly what I told you in an email, but WWF did not want to pony up the money to buy out all of the guaranteed contracts that the big boys had, like Goldberg, like Scott Steiner, like Hulk Hogan, Hall and Nash, Flair, Sting, and everybody else. Instead, they settled for Booker T and DDP as the big invading stars. Oh, and Lance Storm, too. Lance Storm was that first WCW wrestler to invade. There's a trivia question for you. Who was the first WCW guy to show up on Raw? It was Lance Storm. along with a whole bunch of low to mid-level guys rounding out the group. Now, they did one big buy rate for the Invasion pay-per-view in July of 01. It was WrestleMania-esque. It was a good year for them in terms of pay-per-view buy rates. Aside from that one big buy rate, the entire thing flopped. You will never, ever be able to convince me otherwise. Now, WWF business, TV ratings, were much bigger than they were now. Than they are now, I should say. But that's not because of the Invasion, it was just because wrestling was popular back then. If anything, the Invasion did more to kill that than any other angle at the time. Now, in fairness, what helped it flop was the fact that the group led by... This is the thing that boggles my mind when I think about it. The Alliance, as it ended up being referred to as, was led by a WWF superstar. That, of course, was Stone Cold Steve Austin, whose heel turn, which I thought was really entertaining, be that as it may, it was a failure in hindsight. It did more to hurt Stone Cold and hurt WWF than anything else, and we know this because it wasn't even a full year before they turned him babyface again. So you have this invading group led by a WWF guy. That was mistake number one. Now, over the next 2 years or so, what ended up happening? WWF brought in Ric Flair. They brought in the New World Order. They brought in Eric Bischoff. They brought in Big Papa Pump. They brought in Goldberg. And so on and so forth. All the big stars that they did not want to pay top dollar for, they ended up getting them anyway. Only by then it was too late. Had they ponied up the cash for even half those guys at the beginning, bring in Bischoff and Flair, they would have made that money back and then some. I mean, who knows? Perhaps the fate of WCW as a brand would have been different had some of those names come over from the very beginning. That's my main problem with the Invasion. The potential that was there got squandered. They half-assed it from the beginning and lost millions. They lost millions of dollars because they were too cheap. Now, this, by the way, is from a company that at that time was grossing hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So, that's my problem with the Invasion. If you would have taken a group of 20 wrestling fans, you probably would have gotten 20 different ideas on how to go about handling the Invasion, and I can almost guarantee you that out of those 20 fans, 17 or 18 of them, their ideas would have been better than the one that they went with. And you can't sit there and say that their hands were tied because these guys were under contract, they couldn't get them. Yes, they were under contract, and they were probably okay sitting at home collecting money from Time Warner and not working. But I'll tell you what, if they really wanted half those guys, they could have ponied up the cash and they could have gotten them. And they didn't do that. Because they thought it's not worth it. Why are we going to pay this guy $6 million to buy out his contract and come work for us? You know, that's a ridiculous amount of money to spend on one person, and I agree, it's a lot of money, but you would have made that money back. You could have hyped up for months a real interpromotional pay-per-view. The Invasion pay-per-view, while it was good and it made a lot of money, again, it was a half-ass attempt. I mean, you had Jeff Hardy and RVD, great match, you had the main event. I don't know, was the main event really all that great? You tell me. I mean, wouldn't you have loved to have seen Goldberg versus Austin? Or Ric Flair in a match, staying against The Undertaker? I mean, it could have been so much better than it was. So, don't tell me that the Invasion was not a flop, because it was. It was the most... It was the greatest potential for that company to make money, in terms of an angle or a storyline that has ever in their lifetime been dumped in their lap. And they got one buy rate out of it. You could have gotten multiple buy rates out of it. You could have gotten a whole other brand out of it. Of course, they killed off the WCW brand, thanks in large part to Booker T and Buff Bagwell, but that's a different story for a different day. So, that's my spiel on the Invasion. People will have their opinion. I have my opinion. I'm right, they're wrong. That's just the way it is. Deal with it. Alright, now that I got that off my chest, I'm going to end with a plug here for one of our esteemed listeners. Evan writes in. Just wondering if you can make mention of this on your next Sound Off, going to be an insane event featuring the pro wrestling guerrilla debut of the whole effing show, Rob Van Dam. Wrestle Reunion is taking place in Los Angeles It's January 29th through the 31st at the LAX Hilton Wrestle Reunion. It's basically a wrestling fan convention. I believe they've had them before, unless I'm thinking of a different convention, but I'm sure whether they have or they haven't, this year's event will be fun. It's too bad. It's times like this I wish I lived on the West Coast, but if you are on the West Coast or are willing to travel to the West Coast, you can go to WrestleReunion.com. Ring of Honor will be having a live show on January 29th at the Wrestle Reunion event. A lot of their top stars will be appearing, Jay and Mark Briscoe, the Young Bucks, who of course just got signed by TNA. They'll now be referred to as Generation Me. That's their new name. The American Wolves, the Kings of Wrestling will be there. There will be a non-title match between Ring of Honor champion Austin Aries and Jushin Thunder Liger. That has the potential to be pretty awesome. Couple of other matches. Tyler Black will be there, the Human Tornado, Necro Butcher, El Generico, Colt Cabana, and a bonus match. This is on January 29th. Living legend Larry Zbysko, one-on-one with Scotty Two Hotty. Talk about a styles clash right there. Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, PWG, will be presenting Kurt Russell Mania. I shit you not. It is a real event paying tribute to the greatness that is Kurt Russell. I can rattle off an entire list of Kurt Russell movies that I love. Breakdown is one of his more underrated films, by the way. Go look it up. It was from 1998. And I am a fan of Escape from New York, but I have to say, I saw Escape from New York after I saw Escape from L.A., which I know was just panned by critics. I liked Escape from L.A. Escape from L.A. is one of those movies that you pop in the DVD player, you find it on cable when it's really late at night and it's dark, because it's a dark movie, and you just enjoy it for what it is. So, thumbs up on that. But yes, PWG hosting Kurt Russell Mania at Wrestle Reunion. This is on January 30th. There will be a three-way match for the number one contendership for the PWG World title. Chris Hero against Roderick Strong against Rob Van Dam, making his PWG debut. Couple of other big matches. The Great Muta will be there. It's pretty big right there. The Young Bucks taking on the Human Tornado and Chuck Taylor. El Generico battling Jushin Thunder Liger. Davey Richards in a Tequila Sunrise singles match against Super Crazy. That sounds interesting. Brian Kendrick, who just made his TNA debut, I believe will still be a part of Wrestle Reunion. He's supposed to take on Mr. Wrestling Kevin Steen. And a couple of other matches as well. So definitely check this out. Go to WrestleReunion.com. If WWE and TNA is not your cup of tea, even if it is, the more wrestling there is, the better. So if you're going to be out in L.A., January 29th through the 31st, do go to WrestleReunion.com and check that out. It has the stamp of approval from the Solemn Monster. You can reach the Solemn Monster, by the way, at thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solemnmonster. Coming up on episode 98, coming up next week. We're getting ever so close to triple digits here, episode 100. I've reached out to a certain person to see if he would like to partake in the festivities for that show, and we'll see. We'll see if we can put something special together for that. And anyway, those of you who have checked out the podcast in recent days, recent weeks, actually, because we've got a bunch of new listeners. I've been able to track where they're downloading the show from. We've got listeners from literally all over the world. We've got listeners from the U.S. We've got listeners from Canada, Mexico, Paraguay, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Belgium, Italy, Portugal, the Netherlands. I had somebody from, we've had a couple actually from Iraq, one person from Afghanistan, several people from Australia, one from South Africa, I think from Cameroon as well, which was a little bizarre, Ireland, all over the world, and I just want to say thank you. I very much appreciate it. I very much appreciate all the feedback that I have been getting, and keep on listening. There's going to be a lot more where that came from. So until next time, be well, stay safe. We will be right back here for a new show next week.
You've been listening to The Solemn Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there?
I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SE Scoops.